we'll be reading Psalm 13, which, if you've got one of the blue Bibles, is on page 548. For the director of music, a psalm of David. How long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, Lord my God. Give light to my eyes or I will sleep in death, and my enemy will say, I have overcome him, and my foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me.
Thank you for your welcome and the opportunity to come and bring you greetings from the congregation there at Monney Hall as well. They'll be meeting in about 3 minutes' time. They'll be starting. And know I'm here, they'll be praying for this service here as well this morning. So greetings to you all. It's really important for us to remember that our strengths are almost certainly also our weaknesses. Yeah? Our personal strengths are also almost certainly our weaknesses. So any characteristic we have that strengthens us will almost certainly at times make us vulnerable. So maybe you're an exceptionally kind person. You know that at the same time that will leave you open to weakness at times perhaps of tough and difficult decisions. Maybe you're a very ambitious person, which is a good thing, but you know that alongside with it can come a tendency to ruthlessness, idolatrousness. Maybe you're a very intelligent person. You know that there's a flip side to that. There's an arrogance that can sometimes come with it. Well, I've got a strength that I've learned can often be a weakness. My strength is this: I am never late. I'm never late. Now, I can't say that absolutely, because it's not always down to me. I also have a rather bad memory, so I can sometimes forget appointments altogether. But as long as I've remembered where I'm supposed to be, and as long as everything is in my control, I will never be late. More than that, I will be astonishingly early at most things. So early that I spend more time than I care to admit, sat in my car round the corner of some venue because I've turned up that early. Now this promptness is not because I'm excessively polite. It's because I'm the sort of person that needs to be ahead of the game. I hate being pushed for time. I can't bear having things to do or places to be and not be able to get on with it now. In my house while I was pastoring, Sunday mornings were a classic example. If it was up to me and I didn't have a wife and kids to sort out, I would have been at church an hour early every week because I had so much I felt I needed to do and I wanted to have it all in place and all ready, and I hated the thought of running around at the last minute sorting PowerPoints or having lost my notes or whatever. Now, of course, I couldn't do that because other people, but if it was left to me, that is where I would be, driven by a need always to be one step ahead. Now, you might look at your partner or even say to yourself, weakness? That seems to me to be nothing but a strength. I wish I or my husband or my wife was like that, because they're always late. And there are distinct advantages, actually, to being compulsively early. And habitual lateness is not a good thing. If that's you, stop it. It's not a good thing. And there are good things about being like me, wanting to be early. You won't often find me flapping around unprepared where I'm at something I need to be. I think it can often encourage people, especially in church life, if you're one of those that's there early, ready for things to get going. I think it makes life easier for other people because they're not always standing around thinking, when's he going to turn up? So I think there are strengths. But there are weaknesses that I've realized. There's a number, actually, A couple I can think of straight away. One is, you do waste quite a lot of time. If I could add up all the minutes I spent being early and think of what I could have done instead, I wonder how many years of my life I would have reclaimed. You could have got so many things done in the ridiculously early space that I tend to leave. The other is I tend to get quite grumpy when I need to be anywhere because I just want to be there. I prowl around the house, as my wife puts it. You're prowling, she says, because I've got to be where I've got to be. Maybe the worst thing of all, though, is I can become quite irrational if I have to wait for something. Waiting makes me really rather weird. If I'm not able to get on and do what I want to do when I think I need to do it, my thinking can get quite bizarre. I don't go completely mad, but I do start imagining all kinds of things. I imagine all the things that are going to go wrong because I'm not there in time to sort them out. I imagine scenarios that are bound to unfold if I'm not there to be getting things done. And I can think irrationally about other people who might be holding me up. Don't literally want to kill them, but sometimes. So in this way especially, there's this strength that I have. I'm never late. That is a weakness. I can barely cope with waiting. Well, we find a Psalm of David here where he's been driven to despair by waiting. He wants to get on, but he can't. He's being held back. He's being prevented. And it is driving him desperate. The problem in his case in this psalm is it's God himself who is delaying him. It's God himself whose watch seems to have stopped, whose calendar seems to have got lost somehow, or whose diary seems to just remain closed. As you look at the psalm carefully, you'll see that this is the issue. David's wanting to get on with something, isn't he? He's wanting to get on with experiencing God's help and deliverance. That's his hope and desire in this psalm. As you read through it, you see that there are enemies round about. Enemies appear in verse 2, twice again in verse 4. And they're strong and powerful enemies. Verse 2, it looks like they're triumphing. And there's potential that they're the ones who are going to be rejoicing and gloating over David's downfall in verse 4. And he wants to be rid of them. He wants to get on with his responsibilities as king without being encumbered by these enemies. So in verse 3, he says to God effectively, I'm going to end up dead if you don't do something about this. But what does God seem to be doing? The superficial answer, of course, is that God seems to be doing nothing. And that's absolutely true. But that's not the biggest problem for David, is it, in this psalm? God's inactivity is only, if you like, problem part one. The real problem is that God has been inactive for so very long. The real problem is just not that God isn't doing things. It's that he's not been doing things for such a long period of time. David seems to know that there are mysterious times in God's purposes, sure enough, when God doesn't seem to be doing what we want him to do at any given moment in time. But that's not the problem here. What David can't handle is why God is letting that happen for so long. Why does David have to wait for it to get sorted? When you read those verses, this psalm with those eyes, you'll see it, won't you? This emphasis on the how long. So verse 1, it's not, O Lord, why have you forgotten me? There are prayers like that in the Psalms. It is, how long, Lord, will you forget me forever? Or it's not, Lord, why have you turned your face from me? But how long, Lord, will you turn your face from me? And we have two more how longs there in verse 2. Not just, Lord, why must I wrestle with my thoughts and have sorrow in my heart? But how long? And not just, oh Lord, why are you allowing my enemies to triumph over me? But how long will my enemies triumph over me? So can you see the big issue for David in this psalm? He's desperately trying to deal with God's delay. He's struggling with having to wait for God to do something. I'd like us to think about that this morning, because the how long experience So real, isn't it, in the authentic Christian life? It is so very personally. You could all account for this in one way or another, I'm sure. A myriad of occasions when God not only seems to be inactive, but he seems to prolong that inactivity so much, so unreasonably, it seems, in our personal experience. Our faithful prayers are unanswered for so long, and our tears are unnoticed for so long. What do we do when God makes us wait? Or in the best sermon title I saw in Psalm 13, and then I couldn't find who had thought it up, when God shows up late. Well, what do we do? But actually, you know, on a much bigger scale, the Christian life is a life of waiting. Wrestling with the how long question is built into the very story that we are living. As Christians, we are part of a big story, aren't we? Posh people use the word meta-narratives, don't they? The big story that covers all other stories. The secularist insists that there is no meta-narrative. We're just all a bunch of little, isolated, random stories. But as Christians, we say, no. There's a big story. Everything is moving from first creation to new creation. God is in charge of all of that. There's a meta-narrative. But at the heart of it is this cry of David. How long? How long before creation turns to new creation? How long, God, before you come and do what you have promised and what your people long for? How long for all the suffering and trial of this creation gives way to the glory and joy of the new that you've promised? So, you know, Romans 8 pictures a whole creation groaning for that day. Creation itself wants to see the story ended. The Apostle Peter pictures Christians in great confusion about the apparent postponement of that day. So even back there, they're being ridiculed. How long? How long, Christians, before it's going to happen? The book of Revelation tells us the cry of the persecuted about that day. Revelation 6, they called out in a loud voice, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" So even if there's no immediate how long cry in our particular situation, on the grandest scale, there is for all of us. How long is what Christians cry and cry as they wait for God to bring about his great purposes in his creation? So what do we do? What do we do as we wait? I think there are three things this psalm encourages us to do. Simply as we follow the narrative structure of the psalm, almost the journey of this psalm. This psalm is David, I think, praying through his struggle with the wait. We can simply follow it section by section. First of all, in the first two verses, we need to be aware of the dangers that come to us when we're living in this delay. The dangers, specifically the distorted thinking that can begin to take hold of our minds while we're waiting for God to act. I said earlier that this is one of my big weaknesses in dealing with delays of any kind. If I'm made to wait, I become irrational. Irrational about other people, irrational in about how churned up I get, irrational about how I think about the consequences and so on. My thinking quickly begins to warp if I cannot be or do where I want to be and doing what I want to do when I want to do it. I think verses 1 and 2 are a mass of irrational thinking. Here are impossible things that David is thinking. If I were to summarize, David is imagining God can do something that he knows actually God never can. He's imagined he himself can do something that surely he knows he never can. And he's imagined his enemies can do something that actually he must know they never can. Think about it. First, at the start of verse 1, impossible thoughts about God. David is considering a possibility that in his sane moments he would know are not true. What does verse 1 of this psalm amount to? It amounts to a complete and permanent abandonment by God. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? And the implication, the parallel of that sentence, the hiding of God's face. is assumed to be the same. David allows himself to consider the possibility of permanent abandonment by God. Will you forget me forever? But when David is thinking straight, he knows that's not possible. We have, thankfully, a whole mass of other psalms when David says absolutely that this is not possible. The impossibility of God forgetting his people forever. Psalm 9:18, but God will never forget the needy. The hope of the afflicted will never perish. Psalm 23, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me, and the psalm ends all the days of my life. Psalm 27, though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me. And we could go on and on in David's Psalms where he makes the clear point that he believes God can never reject him forever. But here, because God is delaying his deliverance for so long, David is beginning to contemplate, maybe God could reject me forever. Impossible thoughts about God begin to crowd his mind. Then impossible thoughts about himself at the start of verse 2. How long must I wrestle with my thoughts? Now that doesn't come across terribly well in this particular version. A much more literal translation would be, how long must I take counsel in my soul, is what he's saying. Which is a slightly uncertain phrase, but most certainly seems to have the idea, how long do I have to take the responsibility on myself? How long do I have to do the worrying? Why do I have to be the one who needs to try and sort this out? That seems to be behind this. Lord, it's so long you are delaying. How long do I have to deal with these problems, these enemies, myself? How long must I take counsel in my soul? Like what happens in my home situation more often than I care to admit. Haley, my wife, asked me to do something. Yes, dear, I'll do it. But my timetable and her timetable don't always coincide. So I know I'm going to do it, and I know when I'm going to do it. When I come to do it, she's already done it. I say, why have you already done it? Well, I couldn't wait any longer for you to do it. Part of our domestic bliss. When God doesn't do it, when we want him to do it, what do we think? Well, then perhaps we've got to do it. We've got to take counsel in our soul. We've got to sort this out ourselves. How long, Lord, are you going to leave this up to me? But that's so irrational, isn't it? For David to think that he has the wisdom or the power or whatever it might be to resolve a situation that he can do a better job than God, it's impossible and it's irrational. But in these delays, that's the kind of way we start to think. How many Christians have shipwrecked their faith because they could not wait? The how long was too long. The how long for the partner that God really wanted for them, but he was taking too long about it. The how long for the job situation that they thought was ideal but couldn't wait for God. No, in the how long, our thinking gets distorted about ourselves and our ability to sort these things ourselves. But then there are impossible thoughts about his enemies. How long will my enemy triumph over me? Now, here's probably where we're most sympathetic with David, I think, when his view doesn't seem so irrational, because there were times in his career as king of Israel when he was pretty thoroughly defeated. I don't know for a fact, but I tend to think that all these early psalms were written, the David ones were written around about the time of Absalom, his son's rebellion, when Absalom ousted him effectively as king. And in that time, certainly David appeared to be utterly, utterly on the losing side. His enemies triumphing over him in every way, driven out of Jerusalem by the cruel cunning of his son. And there were other times as well. So maybe when David says, how long will my enemies triumph over me? We can see exactly what he is saying. But what is irrational, impossible, is the totality of the defeat that David seems to be contemplating. These enemies genuinely triumphing over him. That's a strong expression. These enemies really being in the driving seat of everything, really being in charge. How could that possibly be? He is God's king. David is God's anointed. How could enemies ever, ever really triumph over God's anointed? It's an impossibility for David to think that his enemies will really triumph over him. Remember when Jesus was with his disciples and they were crossing the Sea of Galilee and the boat and the violent storm comes up. And his disciples are afraid and Jesus so, it seems to me sometimes almost brutally, denounces their fear. Why are you afraid? And it seems harsh, doesn't it? This is a life-threatening storm. Surely they have a right to be a little bit afraid that their boat is going to go to the bottom of the lake. But surely it is a fear based on an impossibility. What's that boat they are in? What is in that boat? It's the king of God's new kingdom. And in these disciples, the head of God's new people. They should have known that by now. That boat was the most unsinkable boat that has ever set sail anywhere. It could not be destroyed. God's king and his new people are there in the boat. They could not sink. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea, remember this hymn, you're all too young, or demons or men, except for you, or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lies the master of heaven and earth and sky. You see David here, my enemies are going to triumph. David, surely he knows in his sane moments that God's anointed king cannot ultimately be defeated. So can you see the dangers that this time of waiting posed to David and they pose to us? We imagine God doing something he never can, namely leave us forever. We imagine we can do something that we never can, namely, sort our difficulties ourselves, and that our enemies can do something that they never can, which is triumph over the people of God forever. So is it you this morning? You are in a how long period, and it is so real to you. God is delaying his response to you, and he seems to have delayed it for so long. Maybe in reality it's been a short time, but in your mind it is a long time. Maybe it has actually been a long time, and the mystery of the delay is very great. Are you falling for these dangers? Are you thinking irrational thoughts about God? Are you thinking irrational thoughts about yourself? Are you thinking irrational thoughts about whatever it is that's against you? Maybe we could apply it to the waiting we're all involved in on the grandest scale. How long, God, until this world and its mess? How long until our culture and its mess is sorted out? And as Christians here, as our culture moves rapidly, even more rapidly away from us, if I'm ever asked, the difference is now in being a Christian pastor than when I started 30 some odd years ago, one of the differences, our culture is hurtled away from us, even in the last decade. And is hostile to us and what we believe in a way I could not have imagined even when I started pastoring. And it can leave us desperate. How can we keep going? How long, Lord? We need to see what David now does in response to this. He prays these irrational prayers. But now he comes to pray sensible prayers. And now in verses 3 and 4, he deliberately prays against these very dangers, these very distorted thinking. So verses 1 and 2, I've described as a mass of irrationality. And when we look at them, I think it is David praying what he knows in his best moments cannot be possible. But now in verses 3 and 4, now he begins to pray sensibly. And he begins to pray, if you like, directing himself against these very distortions. Now, it's important to acknowledge that verses 1 and 2 have been prayer, anguished prayer and confused, pleading, even irrational. But it is prayer, and more, I'd like to say that it is a legitimate kind of prayer. God loved to hear verses 1 and 2 as much as he loves to hear verses 3 and 4. Because God loves to hear the cries of our hearts, doesn't he? And even sometimes when it's overruling the knowledge of our head, there are times when God loves to hear us express what it is that we are feeling in the depth of our being. But our prayers mustn't stop there. And eventually, if you like, the thoughts of our heart have to be instructed by the knowledge of our head. We've got to turn from what we feel to what we know, from what's coming up here, if you like, from our being to what has been sent down from here by God in his word. And David does exactly this, because now he turns to these positive requests for help. Look, he says, and answer and give light. But I want you to notice that these are directly addressing the concerns of verses 1 and 2. Can you see this? So verses 1 and 2 begin with a cry to God, then a cry about David himself, then a cry about his enemies. Well, verses 3 and 4 follow the same pattern. Look on me and answer, Lord my God. That's a cry now to God. Give light to my eyes, or I'll sleep in death. That's a prayer about himself. And my enemy will say, I have overcome him. My foes will rejoice when I fall. That's a prayer about his enemies. So having expressed these deep-seated cries to God, it's almost as though David says, but I'm not going to give in to those thoughts. These distorted thoughts that are coming into my mind about God or myself or my enemies, I'll not let them dictate what I'm going to believe. So David might feel permanently abandoned and feel that he has to work it out himself and feel that his enemies are triumphing. But it's as though he draws a line after verse 2 and says, but no more, no more. Now I'm going to think of these things as they really are. So he prays now to a God who he claims is caring and is close. Look on me and answer, Lord my God. That though those words for look and those words for answer are very intimate words when they're connected with God in the Bible. If God looks and sees, then he has a personal interest in. He cares and he is concerned. And when he looks, he then answers. And this is the opposite of the God of verse 1, the forgetful, the hidden God. There at the start of Psalm, this is a complete change of view. Now David is acknowledging this God looks and this God will answer. How has this change of view come about? I don't know. As David suddenly begun to recollect all the promises of God that he piles up in other Psalms, I like to imagine maybe deciding to at last think about how God has really acted in history. David has 1,000 years to look back on, at least, since God dealt with Abraham, his forefather. And he can say, has God ever forgotten his people forever? However long it has been? Maybe he thinks of Hagar, remember Abraham's wife, cast out into the desert by an angry Sarah. And in her distress, God meets and provides for her. And she gives God a name, doesn't she? You, God, are the one who sees me. You, God, are the one who sees me. Those Victorian posters, you know, with a big eye, thou, God, seest me, meant to terrify children, are actually taken from one of the most lovely verses in the Bible. Hagar in her distress, thou, God, seest me. Maybe David remembered that. Or Jacob on the run from the brother he cheated, lying with a stone for a pillow, and God sees him and meets him. Joseph languishing in an Egyptian jail despite great faithfulness, but God sees. Or the Israelites, desperate slaves in Egypt. The day comes when God sees and he hears and he answers. Or Moses after 40 years in the wilderness when God sees and answers. And it could go on. Was this David's chain of thought? No idea. But the fact is he now prays in a way that directly contradicts how his heart has been feeling and addresses a God he knows will pay attention and will come to his aid. And then David prays for himself, now in full acknowledgement of his personal need. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death. And if we've read the first part of verse 2 rightly, how long must I take counsel in my own soul? How must I deal with this myself? Well, he's saying the opposite now. Give light to my eyes. If you don't do that, I will sleep in death. This is a prayer for God-given wisdom, recognizing that to be consumed by that kind of worry is ultimately fatal. So before, how long must I take counsel in myself? How long must I take this burden on myself? Now he's saying, God, give me what I need. Give light to my eyes, because I cannot bear this burden myself. It's a prayer of genuine submission, recognizing God, the need for God's help. Just like Psalm 42:5. Why, my soul, are you so downcast? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God. It's what David does in these verses. Or as the Apostle Peter would later tell us, cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. And actually, fascinatingly, those verses in 1 Peter 5 are in the context of young men desperate to be elders. Peter's saying, humble yourself under God's mighty hand. In due course, he will lift you up. Cast all your cares on him because he cares for you. People who can't wait, in that context, in 1 Peter, Peter's saying, you wait. God knows. God will lift you up in his own time. And then he prays about his enemies, now recognizing what's really at stake there in verse 4. Now, the prayer in verse 2 and the prayer in verse 4 sound pretty much the same at verse. How long will my enemy triumph over me? In verse 4, my enemy will say, I've overcome him. My foes will rejoice when I fall. Because in both, David's concerned about suffering and personal defeat. But there is something different about the prayer in verse 4. In this second prayer, it's not only the experience of defeat he's concerned about, it's the announcement of that defeat, the declaration of that defeat. My enemies will say, my foes will rejoice. And David is now concerned that his defeat will become known and it'll become the object of boasting by his enemies. If we're cynical, we might say that just means David is selfish and doesn't want to be embarrassed. But if we're reading David's motives right here, there is a change of focus. And now he is concerned again for the glory of God, the reputation of God. So he's saying, God, if you let these enemies triumph, they will rejoice, they will boast. And your glory will be diminished. That is what comes to the surface. David's not just an individual here, is he? He's the king of God's people. If he's defeated, what does that mean? It means that God's glory is denied. Now, we're not David, are we? We're not, and our enemies are not David's enemies. But we're all called to see this battle in exactly the same perspective, a gospel perspective that's supremely concerned about God and his glory. If we're crying out, how long? Is it purely because we are discomforted? Is it purely because we are impatient? Or is it because we're saying, God, the longer you wait to do something, the more your name is dishonored, the more your enemies boast over you? So during the dangerous period of God's delay, be very careful about the distorted thinking that can come into our mind. And then we pray against those very distortions. And then finally in verses 5 and 6, we return to the ultimate foundation of everything. We've got to get back to the one thing that is at the absolute essence of everything about God we need to know that is confusing at times like this. God's unbreakable love shown in his great salvation. That's the foundation of everything. Everything that we find so disturbing at times when we're crying out, how long? We get back to this rock, God's unbreakable love and his great salvation. But I trust your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me. See the journey that's happened through the course of this psalm? From the despairing cry there in verses 1 and 2 to these declarations of confidence in verses 5 and 6. Because David has worked it through. He has poured out his irrational mind. He has prayed against that irrationality with solid truth. And now he comes to what it all rests on. I trust and my heart will rejoice. Now, if you get different versions, some say, I trusted you and my heart will rejoice. Some say, I have trusted and my heart rejoices. We could go on. That's the joy of the Hebrew language. But it all amounts to the same thing. It points to unfailing love. Not just love. It's that Hebrew word. I pretend like I know, remember it, any of my Bible college Hebrew. I hardly do. But some of you will know the word hesed, covenant, love, committed love, unbreakable love. The love that God chooses to place on people and never, never, never removes. So that is the total opposite of what David has been contemplating in verse 1. A God who could forget him forever? No. Now he's speaking about God's covenant love. And it has led to salvation. My heart rejoices in your salvation, both in the past and in the future, in David's experience. And that is David's ultimate hope. That's his bottom line. That's the rock where his floundering feet have come to settle at the end of this psalm. You can see how far he's traveled from that forgetful, apparently unconcerned God at the beginning to the God of covenant salvation at the end. And if David had such a rock, how much more do we? If we think of God's unfailing love leading to salvation, to us those aren't ideas, are they? To us those aren't concepts. To us, that is a person. That has all been embodied to us in a way that the great King David could only vaguely see. To us, God's unfailing love leading to salvation is bound up in a person, the person of Jesus Christ, the person who has come and lived and died and was raised again for our salvation. If David could find a rock for his feet on God's unfailing love and salvation, how much more? And even more when we think that that very person was the one, if you like, who would have been able to take verse 1 on his lips in a way that we never could. A person who actually prayed at one point, my God, why have you forsaken me? And there was some reality about it, however mysterious, that is not something any of us can ever experience, but he did. And he is the one, because he did that, guarantees that we never have to. So you see, David comes at the end to this rock of his salvation, his unfailing love. And that's for all of us. Our ultimate hope in the unbreakable love of God leading to salvation through the suffering of his own Son who loved us and gave himself for us. So his weight almost killing you? Is the delay driving you to distraction? In some personal aspect of your life at the moment where that how long cry is so real, or even on the biggest scale of a world seems to be running away from God, don't let your thinking be distorted. Pray God's truth against those very distortions and come in the end to the Lord Jesus, the epitome of unfailing love and salvation. Amen.